Ignition number 11281, reel 8.
But they were wooden structures with a big wooden wheel on the front. And they had two wooden arms that stretched from the wheel right along the back. And they must have been about 5 or 6 foot long, actually, from the wheel at the front to the two handles at the back. And all they had was a platform laid on the top, wide at one end where the handles were, and narrowing down towards the wheel. And at the wheel end, there was another a piece protruding upwards at the end. So I used that like a backrest, and I got Captain Powell onto this thing with his legs stuck up towards the shafts. And he was in a sitting position with his back to this panel that came up above the wheel. And I wheeled him down the garden path. Oh, put the Bren gun on his chest. I remember putting the Bren gun on his chest as well. And I wheeled him down the path. And I had to turn round and pull it up a couple of steps into the rooms of the house. And I wheeled him through and out through the front door. And I came out into the street, into blazing sunshine in the street on the other side. The house was dark and cool. And I don't know, it must have been a fairly big house. But, you know, as I say, I just wheeled them right through the doorways, and the wheelbarrow went through, all right, and out the front door and into the street. And within seconds, where it came from, I don't know, they had jeeps, which were converted into very fragile types of ambulance. And they just had, instead of the passenger seat, they had a stretcher put in on the side there. And then they had an iron frame which went up and held two stretchers on the top. So they could carry three wounded men, very precariously, I think, you know, but they used to get strapped in. I think they had canvas straps on them. And that pulled up, and we put them on that, and that was the last I saw of Captain Powell.
So all that business of you getting over the wall was done in full view of the Germans?
They shot him running up to the wall, so they must have been able to see us trying to get over that wall. And that's all I can say, I think, that they stopped shooting at us because it was so comical. They must have, and they probably knew that, but there was no way that we were going to do any damage to them. Nothing then onwards. But they're the things that amazed me, you know, about war. How, you know, they can be so dramatic and tense at times. And then you can have these idiotic things like that happening in it. There's no way that I could describe it, the feeling that you have. And when that jeep drove away, the loneliness that I felt standing there in this road by myself, and not a soul around me. And there's a link. And when you come to think of it, the mass of material and the stuff that was getting put ashore, the shells and the firing that was going on, and all that thing, and there quietly standing there was a bedraggled young Marine standing in the street, clutching an empty Bren gun and watching his troop commander whistled away, and standing there bereft. And where was I going to go? What was I going to do? How was I going to link up again with the battle? Though, would I just sit down and it would all flow past me? As it happened, it didn't. The Sergeant Hazelhurst was the man who appeared from nowhere, and the audacity to ask me where I'd been. And he said, "Right." I said, "I've got no ammo." It took him about 5 seconds, I think, to produce it, much to my surprise, and I wasn't very happy about it. And he hung all these things around my neck, these bandoliers of ammo. No more cardboard boxes. He hung these bags of ammo around my neck and told me to get into a house, pointed a house just behind me. Probably the house I'd just come out. Oh, no, it wasn't, no. Because when I went to the door, it was a big studded door. Oh, that's right, yes. The humiliation there. Being a Bren gunner, I then had a personal weapon of the Colt 45, which I've mentioned before. And that was supposed to be your personal weapon. Anybody who had a specialist weapon like a Bren gun or a mortar or a Pierce also had a personal weapon of a 45 pistol, automatic pistol, because he couldn't carry a rifle. So I took this pistol out and I fired at the door, you know, the way you see them on the films. And I fired one shot at it and there was a tap on my shoulder, and when I turned round, there's I can only describe him as a priest standing there with his cassock and his robes out, and they wore a round flattish hat, you know, on his head, and his head was shaking, and he reached forward and turned the knob and opened the door. And I slunk inside. And I went up to the bedroom and cried my eyes out. I just stood there and cried. I thought I made a complete and utter mess of the whole thing. And it didn't seem like, you know, all the training. And I realised just how immature that I must be, you know, young, green, whatever you call it, what you like. And that what I was doing there, God only knew. Because at the time I didn't. And when I had recovered a little bit, I filled the magazines and put the gun. And then I remember the training taking over. Again, don't break the windows. Leave the curtains where they are. Don't put the gun right up by the window. Keep it well back. And all those things started going through my mind again. And I suppose I started functioning like a soldier again then. That it started to go dark then, and that was my D-Day. That, and I thought, good Lord. So I didn't sleep that night. I sat on that bed, looking out that window, back to the way in roughly the direction where I'd come from during the day. And the night passed. I think somebody came and brought me tea. I think, you know, but that's all that happened. And the next day, of course, there was a bit of a scare saying that the Germans were still up the road, but the Captain Powell had gone, and the young lieutenant, the only other lieutenant of the left in the troop, Lieutenant Stevens, he took over what was left of the troop. And there was a report that came from the French, that the Germans were up the road. And this fellow, there's no more than gets a couple of men and wanders up the road to find the Germans. And he turned out to be one of the finest soldiers I've ever known. Or the finest soldier I've ever known, Mr. Stevens. He was promoted to captain and he became the troop commander. And he was an incredibly brave man. And there was no way that you could refuse to do what he wants you to do, because he wouldn't ask you to do anything that he wouldn't do himself. And if he always led from the front. And there was no question about it. He was an excellent officer. Great. Anyway, as a lieutenant, he toddled up this road and he was away for ages. And they came back again. He says, nobody up there. And he had complete utter disdain for danger. So we formed up later on in the afternoon and off we went. We marched away. And right in the direction where we'd been attacking the day before. And you could walk quite freely. The Germans had withdrawn during the night. Because the Canadians were on the other side of them, I suppose. And they not knowing what the situation was, they pulled all their forces back to consolidate, I suppose. So we walked quite freely then, where the day before you couldn't move without getting shot at. And at what happened to then?
What was the nearest village that you were near?
Lyon-sur-Mer. Lyon-sur-Mer.
How do you spell Lyon?
Just like L-I-O-N, Lyon. And it's just an hyphen, S-E, and M-U-R. Lyon-sur-Mer, I think that's the way you spell it. And we moved out then, and we moved to towards a chateau, and there was supposed to be a German headquarters there or something. And we're after us manoeuvring ourselves around the place and preparing to attack it, it turned out there was nobody in there. But I think Captain Stevens just walked right into it just to find out if we were there. He was that kind of fellow. So that was an abortive thing. So that passed another day away, trying to do that. And then I think we went to a radar station around about that time, near a place called Douves, was it? Yeah, Douves. That was the nearest town. On the way to Bayeux in that area, and this radar station was there, and they had hoped to capture it on the first day, but in actual fact they didn't, and they merely surrounded it, they left it isolated and all swept past it, and the Canadians had hit it. And when we arrived there, the position that we had to take up around this radar station from one of the points where the Canadians had bumped it, and there in front of our positions in the open ground, we took the nearest cover to them, and it must have been about 600 yards of dead flat open field, and you could see the wire and the bunkers and the gun emplacements on top of these concrete bunkers that they had. And Sherman tank was been knocked out in the middle of the field. And alongside it was a Canadian soldier just lying there. So Captain Stevens didn't like that at all. So one of the first things we did was patrolled out that night and brought the Canadian in, back in again. Because one thing we don't like is leaving our dead behind. And it was a sort of unwritten law that if we could get them back, we got them back, you know. So we brought this chap in. He'd been lying there since D-Day, I suppose. So, and we buried him. Told the Canadians authority, the word was passed back anyway, the Canadian authorities. And we took up residence around this radar station while I think it was from the point of view of gathering the commando back again and reforming it and finding out just who was who and what was what. And I think we got joined up with P Troop to make a full troop, or something like a troop. But even then, we only mustered about 30 men, where we should have had something like about 100 and odd. So we were well below strength. But nevertheless, the little respite and being able to look at this radar station meant that we had the enemy there pinned, where we could see him. And he didn't seem to want to do anything about coming out, although he was very, very alert to you trying to get in. Every time we approached it, and we did many, many little patrols against it from different angles, and cutting the wire, it was very well booby-trapped, and It'd be a very dangerous situation, you know. And as soon as you started to cut the wire, he seemed to know. And then he would daisy cut. And they had guns. We found out guns firing about waist high, or chest high. And they'd fire them and make you duck. And as soon as you ducked, they'd fire the, what they call the daisy cutters. And they'd be firing at almost ground level, you know. So they'd get you when you went down. So it was a bit hairy at times when on patrol against them.
Did you suffer casualties in those probes?
You'd always lose, at the odd man here and there, you know, all the time, and every time you went out, you know. But we succeeded in getting the tank back as well. We went and caused a diversion while the Royal Engineer, the tank recovery people, and they drove that great big tractor type of thing out into that field. And they got into the tank and took it out of gear and winched it aboard this thing and brought it back. Well, we placed silly beggars around the wire with the Germans. But they brought the tank back in again. All that was in this was a little hole about the size of your finger. The only damage you could see to it. So whatever it must have been, an infantry anti-tank weapon that hit it. It must have just hit it on the right spot. And this little bullet went right through, you know, and disabled it. And then the chap must have been killed getting out of it. I don't think there's anybody else in it. I can't remember. And the other thing that happened there, was my horse riding expertise there. We were appalled at the smell that started to come around, and when we investigated, round the back of some buildings there were stables, and some beautiful horses. They'd all been killed by the Germans, riding horses, you know. And there was one left, one horse, still alive. And all the saddles and bridles still hanging up there. So my father was very fond of horses, and he was a horseman in the last war, the 1914 war. And I'd always been associated with horses because horses were part and parcel of the life. And there were a great many stables, and there were shire horses, magnificent shire horses in use in Liverpool in my young day, you know. So I saddled the horse and I put the bridle on it, and I wasn't afraid of them, although I'd never ridden them. And I hopped up onto the back of this one, and I rode it round a bit, you know. And I used to go ride down for the mail, down to the beach to pick up the mail every morning. That was very, very nice. Apart from one day, they'd built an airstrip just behind us. The matter, you know, 300 or 400 yards. And they levelled off this field, and they used to put what they call Sommerfeld track, like a wire mesh stuff, on the floor. And anyway, these Spitfires and Hurricanes and that were coming in, landing there. And of course, unaware of that, the path that I took just missed the end of this airfield. But I was riding there one day, down towards the beach, and this aircraft came in to land. Well, the noise, and the horse just took off. There was no way that I could control that animal. He had a mind of his own, and he had far stronger than I was. So all that, I just hung on, prayed to God, and hoped that he'd stop eventually, which he did. But that was a nice little sideline for me. That, you know, I enjoyed that a little bit. I looked after that horse. And as I say, we weren't troubled by the Germans in the in this radar station. If we left them alone, they left us alone. They didn't snipe you during the day, you know. We had no problems of snipers or anything like that. And but of course, eventually the time comes when the powers that be say, right, enough's enough, take them out. So the plan was for us to go in one night and occupy part of it, and then the remainder of the commander would attack in the morning. So we mounted this big fighting patrol. And we had Bangalore torpedoes, which the engineers brought. And one engineer came with us to detonate it. And you connected these Bangalore. They were like tubes. I don't know whether you know anything about them. They were like scaffolding tubes filled with high explosive. And they had cuts on one end, like a bayonet lamp holder type of thing. So the way you put the lamp in, and the two little spikes on the bottom of the lamp engage in it. Well, that's the way the Bangalore torpedo was like. At one end, it had the cups, the little cuts for the pegs to go in, and the other end had the pegs on, and each one was made the same. So you could link them all together, you see, and just twist them, and you'd have one big long scaffolding pole eventually. So everybody carried about 6 foot length of this, and we gave them to the engineer, and then took up our lot of positions. And the idea was that we'd push this under the wire, right through the wire, and when I'd pushed them in far enough, or we assumed we'd pushed them in far enough, the engineer would detonate them. And this, the explosive that was in it, I think it was an explosive called amatol, which was a blasting explosive more than a penetrating explosive. And it would blast all the wire out of the way and detonate any mines that were underneath it at the same time. And it used to do that. It did actually do that. Not quite as clearly and cleanly as you might imagine, but you still got caught on strands of wire, etc., and things like that. But basically, it did what they said it would do. And we hooked all these things together. They were duly detonated, and the plan was that we would all run in, but it had to be single file, you see, which was the danger. And, of course, if we happened to run in and we ran straight down the muzzle of somebody's machine gun, we would get an enormous number of casualties, you know, for very little worth. But it was a chance that had to be taken, so they said, well, we'll everybody run. And you start running. So we had to look away so that when the blast came, it didn't affect your eyes. And then turn back. But then, of course, when you did that, and you looked away from the spot where everybody's eyes were focused on it, although you couldn't see it clearly in the dark, when you turn away and you turn your head back, you just can't locate it immediately. But anyway, everybody started running sort of towards the hole. There was a bit of a chaotic thing getting in there, and Captain Stevens was in the front again. And the idea was that if the volume of fire came down, which was very great, we were to turn back without any orders, to turn back and get out. So it was left pretty much to every man to make his own estimation on what he considered it to be a heavy fire. But as it happened there, the Germans did open up straight away. As soon as the explosion had gone, we started to run, so they started to fire. And of course, they were firing tracer, and you know, it was flashing all over the place. So everybody just turned on the heel, and we just ran out. But we didn't go too far away, where there was a crater which had been left by a bomber or something, and that was the RV place. So we all ran back to that, got down, and waited, and hoped that the Germans would come out. Looking for somebody who'd been messed about with their doorstep. But they didn't, so that plan was aborted. But that was the idea. We were supposed to get in that night, occupy the German trenches as much as we possibly could, form a little defensive block inside, and then we could shoot at anybody who was interfering with the rest of the commando as they came in during the morning. The next morning. However, that didn't happen. So they decided on a straightforward set-piece attack. So we were given a couple of assault engineers who had these Churchill tanks adapted with, what do we call the thing down there? Oh, petards. Petards. Yeah. And beehives they had. And they trundled up over the wire and blew up any anti-personnel mines, and we followed behind. And we did that in broad daylight. And that was the most curious attack I've ever known in my life. We all wandered in at the back of these tanks and spread out and occupied the various positions that the Germans had built there. And without any shots being fired, that was during the day. And I remember when we turned round and looked back from where we came from, the RAF had turned up from their airfield, and it was like a football match. The spectators standing not more than 300 yards away while we were attacking this place. The most curious thing, and I don't know what would happen if the Germans had suddenly opened up. They'd have had some smashing targets to aim for. But nothing happened, and we found that they had slit trenches, and they were beautifully dug. And they ran, they were communication trenches, as well, really, that ran between, that's why we never saw them. They ran between each bunker was linked by a series of these trenches, and beautifully kept. And across the top, they had wire mesh, like rabbit wire, pinned across the top, and sods of earth put over the top. And it was growing grass. And they camouflaged themselves. The ones that we caught in the trenches, once we found them, we got down, that's it, hunt them out and winkle them out, because that's what you had to do. Although there was no firing, they gave up. Once they found you were in there, they didn't want to fight. And once we got in amongst them, they just surrendered, you know. Hundreds of them surrendered to us. And they outnumbered us by 3-1, really. But around their helmet, they had a piece of inner tube, rubber inner tube from a tyre or of a vehicle. And they're just a thin strip. And their round helmets, of course, are ideal for camouflage. And they just put grass in this elastic band. And you couldn't see them. They just came down and they could see you quite clearly. And they could have their head and shoulders over the top of the ground. And you couldn't even pick them up. They were very, very good. And these camouflage capes that they had thrown over them. They were very smart. Anyway, we got them out of there and they surrendered then. Packed it up altogether. So we had a bit of a relaxy-voo day after that. We were allowed to undress and wash and clean up and generally relax completely, you know.
How long had it taken you to capture the station?
Well, we'd been around the station for, say, about a week or maybe more. But then, of course, as I say, I don't know whether the object of us being there that long was merely to build us back up to strength again, or to get us organised into some resemblance of a fighting unit, having been knocked about on the beach. And then from there we moved off a day or so later, and I flogged a horse for a load of to an RASC officer, and in actual fact I had it, and we loaded all our stuff on it because we had no transport, you see, in the troop, and the commando had very little transport, even inside in the commando itself. There were no jeeps and command vehicles and things like that. Everybody was on the feet, transport was. We did have, like, stores vehicles, but, 1,500 weighs me.